Case number 21-5431, Christopher Clayton v. Tri-City Acceptance Incorporated, et al. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Zachary Leroy Taylor for the appellant.
You may proceed, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. I'm pleased to be here. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Zachary Taylor, and I represent the plaintiff, the appellant in this case, Christopher Clayton. Thank you for accommodating us today remotely. I greatly appreciate it. My client appreciates it. And I'd like to thank the court personnel for making this remote hearing possible.
Before you start, I'm noticing the timer is not working.
Yes, sure. I was waiting till the presentation actually began. I could get it kicking right now.
That's fine. I just wanted to make sure it was functional. Okay.
We tested it before and we should be fine. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Thank you. Before I begin the argument, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if it pleases the court.
That's fine.
20 years after this court handed down the decision in Duncan v. Handmaker, litigants are still using credit reports as swords in litigation against the law that Congress promulgated more than half a century ago in the Fair Credit Reporting Act of 1970. The central purpose of that statute was to protect consumers' right to privacy in credit information and credit reports. Users of credit reports, like the appellees, the Tri-City Acceptance, and Betty Byrd, are prohibited from requesting, obtaining, and using credit reports unless they have a lawful purpose. Those purposes are listed. There's an exhaustive, exclusive list enumerated by Congress. Those purposes are known as permissible purposes under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If a user obtains or uses a credit report in violation of that prohibition without having a permissible purpose, a consumer is entitled, an aggrieved consumer is entitled to bring a private cause of action in state or federal court to address that wrong and for vindication of the privacy right granted by Congress.
Okay, counsel, was the violation here just a procedural violation of the statute, or was it substantive in some nature?
This was a substantive violation. The Fair Credit Reporting Act protects the right to privacy, and the violation of the provision of the Fair Credit Reporting Act that prohibited access to credit reports without having a permissible purpose violates the right to privacy. So it was a substantive violation, not a procedural violation, which distinguishes the case from Spokio and from other similar cases.
By the right to privacy, are you referencing to like a common law invasion of privacy claim?
No. So in the complaint, Mr. Clayton brought a common law invasion of privacy claim under state law. There are elements that have to be met under that tort. It is recognized by Kentucky. It's been recognized by Kentucky for 100 or more years. The right to privacy, though, that exists in the Fair Credit Reporting Act is by statute.
I understand that, but isn't part of our analysis to look for historical analog?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you... When you invoke the right to privacy as the basis for, I guess, the purpose of the statute and the violation here, are you drawing a parallel to the common law invasion of privacy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is the FCRA right to privacy in the Fair Credit Reporting Act is analogous to the invasion of privacy tort that has existed in common law for 100 or more years.
I think you're on the right track. I think the court has told us that we're supposed to look to historic analogs when determining whether an injury qualifies as an Article III injury so as to create a case. I guess one concern I have with the argument is that in the grand scheme of things, the right to privacy only dates, it seems to me, to the 1900s or early 1900s. When we talk about looking at history and we're interpreting the Constitution, shouldn't we be looking to a historical analog that dated at the time of the founding? So the common law trespass or other types of tort actions. And I'm curious, number one, if you think that's the relevant time frame, and number two, if there's any analog from that time that would support your position on the right to privacy.
Addressing your first question of the timing, what time frame the court should look at, the law evolves over time. The Constitution was created to be flexible, to allow for the advancement in technologies, and to provide federal court jurisdiction to handle federal law claims that, you know, statutes didn't exist back then. You know, back in at the writing of the Constitution, the technology of computers and data collection.
That's a fair point about the technology. I think what Judge Murphy's asking is, in 1789, was there some kind of common law claim for invasion of privacy, or was that developed later on? And if it's later on, does that matter?
Well, first off, if it's later on, that does not matter, because what the Constitution looks at is the right that Congress created, or the statutory right of action that Congress creates, analogous to a recognized tort claim. Tort claims can evolve. That's the nature of the law. It has to. You know, we have to allow for the law to. I'm sorry.
What's your main authority for the proposition that the case or controversy language from Article III can encompass legal theories that were, or legal torts that were developed later on?
Well, the issue is that if it doesn't, then the courts will have an extremely difficult time handling congressional acts, adjudicating controversies arising under federal law. The issue that, let me back up and talk about the analogous cases back at the founding of the Constitution, 1789. The article that Warren and Brandeis published in 1890, titled The Right to Privacy, published by the Harvard Law Review, discusses the history of the right to privacy. And it talks about how, and there are cases that were cited from the 16th century in that article that provide an analog to invasion of privacy tort as we know it today. Hundreds of years ago, there were cases involving the publication of private letters, and courts would find ways of issuing injunctions prohibiting the publication of private letters. And then that was sort of the genesis of privacy common law. Justice Warren.
Do any of those cases suggest that the mere intrusion on privacy is itself an injury, or do they require some type of derivative injury, such as emotional harm or harms to reputation, or like, you know, lost business dealings? Because I think your position is that just the mere intrusion without more is enough to create an Article III injury.
Absolutely, that is correct. The mere intrusion alone is sufficient to create an Article III injury. Justice Warren and Brandeis wrote, the individual shall have full protection in person and in property. And that principle is as old as the common law. The right to privacy is essentially the right to life. It is the right to enjoy life. The way that the right developed was, well, in ancient law, there were no intangible injuries. Every injury involved realty or personality. There weren't the intangible harms that we know today exist in the law. That seemed unrealistic or unfair to the court system, to the courts. And from there was developed a body of law that protected intellectual property, for example, the right to, from the tort of a battery grew the tort of assault, which didn't involve a physical contact. So over the course of hundreds of years, and really mostly in the course of the last 100 years, the tort of invasion of privacy has evolved and developed. And it alone, it's similar to the tort of trespass, where if someone, a tortfeasor, trespasser, steps foot onto the land of another without permission, that's technically a trespass. Are there damages caused by that? Not necessarily. I notice my timer is out.
If you're at a reasonable stopping place, you'll have your rebuttal time.
Can I ask you one more question before you do stop? So what was the harmful information that was disclosed here to the agency and to the law firm? Is it just the credit score? I mean, lots of the name and other things would be publicly available information. I know you're not alleging there was actual harm, but what was the private information that was disclosed that would be comparable to the common law analog you referenced?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The credit report contained a list of collection accounts. So it showed essentially the creditworthiness negatively impacted. And by the way, the information was truthful, but harmful. It was negative information, but truthful information. The include collection accounts, merchants that Mr. Clayton had business with. It included a list of entities that had requested his credit report, and that might indicate where he was shopping, where he was applying for credit, how often he was applying for credit.
How is this harmful?
It depicts him in a negative light, particularly the collection accounts negatively reflect his creditworthiness. Additionally, let me give you one example.
He wasn't seeking credit. He wasn't seeking credit in this circumstance.
No, he was not.
So this is
his credibility, though, was important in the settlement discussion with the law firm that he had sued for violating the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Of course, you haven't sued the law firm here, so you can't. I mean, whatever damage was occasioned by what the law firm did with the information is not damage you can recover in this case from that law firm, correct?
The Mr. Clayton has subsequently entered into an agreement with that law firm to resolve his claims against that law firm. The FCRA does not allow for apportionment or for subrogation or those sorts of things. So the damages caused by the tortfeasors are not reduced by any recovery that Mr. Clayton received from the law firm he sued. And I'd be happy to, we didn't brief that issue, Your Honor, but I would be happy to brief that issue. There is case law.
I don't know that we need additional briefing. If there's nothing further, you'll have your rebuttal time and we'll turn to your opposing counsel.
Very well, thank you.
Mr. Hard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Jason T. Harden. I'm counsel for the Appalese Tri-City Acceptance and Mrs. Betty Bird. I will apologize in advance for my voice. I am battling a cold, so I will do the best I can this morning. despite the appellate counsel's argument, we believe that the district court's finding that it lacks subject matter jurisdiction because the appellant lacks standing to pursue his claims was correct and was supported by the controlling legal authorities, namely the Buchholz case from this circuit, Spokio, which Mr. Taylor's already referred to. I think most importantly, TransUnion versus Ramirez, the recent ruling of the Supreme Court. And consequently, the district court's ruling in this case should be upheld. If I was looking at this like a boxing match and I was looking at the marquee would say injury in law versus injury in fact. Fortunately, the Supreme Court has already told us who the winner of that fight is. It's injury in fact. Again, referring to TransUnion versus Ramirez, the Supreme Court tells us that an injury in law is not an injury in fact. And without getting into the tall weeds of separation of powers and so forth, I think we can begin with that court's simple statement.
The invasion of privacy tort is now well established. Why, if you're correct, does it mean that that tort essentially can't be brought in federal court?
I believe it can be brought, but there still has to be tangible injuries that come from that right of privacy. And if I could step aside just really quick, though, obviously, I don't think any of us have the original pleadings in front of us. But as I understand how the right of privacy was pled by the appellant, it was pled as a state claim. Three claims survived through the
litigation. I'm not talking, just to be clear, I'm talking about standing now and the consequences of your argument that the invasion of a right to privacy is not itself an adequate article three injury. If that's true, it would suggest in all diversity cases, this now well-established tort couldn't be brought in federal court. I suppose you're correct if you show some type of additional damage from it, like harm to reputation or something, through the use of the information, that would be enough. But at least as I understand the state law concept, it doesn't require that.
Well, it doesn't here, but this is a very narrow issue because in this case, the credit report was disclosed during the course of a deposition. And under Kentucky state law, we have the doctrine of judicial privilege. So you cannot be held liable for a right of privacy violation, a slander, a libel, or anything through communications that's occurring through the legal process, deposition testimony, trial testimony. And in this case, this is where the credit report was disclosed. So I think this is a very narrow issue. I don't think we have to go beyond and tackle the broad questions of how.
Well, if the right to privacy is an adequate analogy, the Supreme Court in TransUnion tells us to look to the common law analog to the federal statute. And it strikes me that what Congress was trying to do with this Reporting Act Credit Reporting Act statute, was to essentially create a zone of privacy around credit reports. And so intuitively, you would think that the common law invasion of privacy tort is the analogous one. And that tort has not historically required anything more than the mere invasion alone. And if I am correct in that legal reasoning, that would suggest that that is the invasion or intrusion on privacy is enough to state a claim, which here would be just the access of the report without authorization. So why is that analogy from common law tort to federal statute mistaken?
I don't think it's necessarily mistaken, and I think your reasoning is well-founded, but I would go back to that this is a fact-specific case, and we could go one step further in this, that not only was the credit report in this case disclosed during a judicial privilege proceeding, but it was actually made an issue in that state case by the appellant himself. In his state FDCPA, Fair Debt Collection Practices case, he argued that that there was damage to his credit report. So in this specific case, the appellant made his credit report an issue. And I think if we look at the body of law, a self-inflicted injury is not an actual injury that can be that satisfies the standing analysis that we have. I think we're not trying to change law here or develop or expand law. I think if we just look at this fact-specific case on how the credit report was utilized in this specific case in light of Spokio, Buckholz, and TransUnion versus Ramirez, it fails the standing analysis. And I think
isn't that a merits argument? You're essentially saying that because he brought it into the proceedings, it was okay for you to use under the statute, but that's not the question that's before us. The question that's before us is standing. And usually when you think about an injury, you have to assume the legal violation. I know you might disagree and you might have very good arguments on the merits, but for purposes of whether he's suffered an Article III injury, it seems to me that we have to assume there has been a violation of this statute and that Ms. Byrd did obtain the report without authorization, so irrespective of whether he put it at issue.
Well, the issue, there was never an adjudication on whether or not there was an underlying violation of the FCRA. And this was a motion for summary judgment, not a motion to dismiss, where you would assume that the facts and the pleadings are correct. Whether this was an FCR case or a run-of-the-mill automobile accident case, I think what gets lost is that this was a motion for summary judgment. So the burden fell on the non-movement, in this case, the appellant, to produce evidence other than their pleadings and other than their own self-serving affidavit. That is, I think, longstanding law, and that's what the district court judge, Judge Hale, focused on, and that's what the appellant failed to do. There was discovery. The appellant was deposed. He filed affidavits in response to the motion for summary judgment. He also filed this essentially a repackaged affidavit in support of his motion to vacate. So the appellant had multiple opportunities to produce something other than what he pled in his pleadings and affidavit.
I'm not sure if I'm totally following you, but to follow up on Judge Murphy's questions, there was a disclosure here. Everyone agrees that there was a disclosure, and the statute prohibits disclosures except for certain circumstances. And maybe you're arguing that one of those circumstances is met, which might go to the merits. I'm not sure that the circumstance you articulated is one the statute recognizes. But for purposes of standing analysis, there was a disclosure. And do you agree that included, I'm not sure what you agree to, but it included information that maybe was not otherwise publicly available? And why isn't that disclosure itself at least enough to violate some kind of privacy concept that was in existence in 1789?
Well, I don't think you could say a disclosure. If it is protected under judicial privilege, I would think the disclosure would have to be dissemination to something outside.
The statute says disclosure, and then it gives a bunch of exceptions. So I know the statute, I'm not sure that works. Maybe
the judicial privilege is a state law privilege. The federal law would preempt the state law if there was a conflict between the two. And the question is, did not with respect to her use of it at the deposition, but with respect to her obtaining of it for an improper purpose. And it's just the mere obtaining of the thing for an improper purpose. I know you may have good arguments on the merits, but for purposes of standing, it seems to me we have to, even at the summary judgment stage, assume a violation and ask, is the mere disclosure from TransUnion to Ms. Byrd a violation?
Well, I would disagree. I don't believe it's, you would assume that the facts are, because again, that's a standard for a motion to dismiss.
Yeah, on remand, if we reverse, you can move for summary judgment on the merits. And then they would have to present proof and we'd get into what the Fair Credit Reporting Act means. But I don't think we necessarily do that for purposes of standing.
Right. What we've got now is a summary judgment motion that was based on the issue of standing, and that's what we're reviewing. And it's not, in all likelihood, we would not reach other issues that were raised or might have been raised in connection with the summary judgment motion. If we don't agree with the district court, it would probably be, we would probably remand. So all the merit stuff is sort of a little beside the point for today's purposes.
And I would agree, Your Honor. I think we have to look at the district court's analysis. And the district court correctly used the three-element analysis that was set out in Spokio. But I think the district court's order honed in on this question of whether or not there was an injury in fact. I know there were basically, to try to simplify it, three areas of damages that.
What is your response to? I mean, there was a disclosure. You've conceded that there was a disclosure. Why is that itself not give your friend on the other side's client standing here?
Well, because I think, again, what the Supreme Court held in TransUnion, that the Congress can create a statutory violation, but ultimately the court's going to decide through separation of powers whether or not that is an actual injury. The courts decide what is an injury in fact, not Congress.
And so I think it's been pretty well developed through the argument that one of the tests here is to look to whether it's an historical analog, maybe in 1789, maybe later. And there's at least some evidence that privacy or intrusion by seclusion, some one aspect of the privacy right, is well established.
And I think by analogy, we could look at how the course also addressed also these more intangible injuries like emotional harm and psychological harm. The courts acknowledge that can be an injury in fact, but it can't be generalized. It can't be just generalized anxiety. It cannot be just generalized psychological harm.
That's off the table here. I mean, we're sort of assuming for this purpose that the plaintiff hasn't put forward any actual harm along those lines.
Exactly. That's what we'd be looking at.
In TransUnion, the dividing line was whether the information was disclosed or not. From information that was in the file that was never disclosed to anyone, the Supreme Court said there was no standing. But for the plaintiffs who had their information disclosed, they said there was standing. I'm not saying that's perfectly applicable here, but I just don't know what your answer is on that.
Well, I think it's interesting, I'm getting the citation right. I can't recall if it's Spokio or Buchholz, but in that case where it was talking about the attainment of a credit report, and I think there was the phrase of the credit report, even if it's improperly obtained, if it's just placed in the collection company's file, does it make a sound? You know, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? And I think that analogy applies here. That even if you assume for argument's sake that it was an improper obtainment of the credit report being disclosed solely in the course of a deposition, does that rise to the level of an injury in fact? Does it make the proverbial sound that no one outside?
What happens? Imagine if somebody hacks into somebody else's emails and just starts reading all their emails. If you wouldn't be able to sue over that, unless you showed some type of additional injury, like emotional harm, or they use the emails for a financial purpose. So the mere intrusion into my email account is not enough for me to sue the person who illegally gains access to the account.
Well, there's already laws that govern, electronic theft and so forth. So I don't know if that's a fair, but if we were just looking
I'm just asking, would I be able to, if somebody hacks into an email account, can the person whose email account is hacked sue the other person? Or do they have to show additional damages of some type of harm? Just the mere act of intrusion, is that enough to create standing?
Statutes aside, if we were just talking common law, I would believe that there would still have to be some manifestation of the harm. I think using Mr. Taylor's own trespass argument, it could be a technical infraction, but there still be no damages.
I think that analogy hurts you. Trespass, if I stepped on somebody else's property, the cause of action was completed. It didn't matter whether there was any real concrete injury. And I do think that that might be the best analogy here. You understand that common law trespass was just stepping on somebody else's property. It was complete. There was no damage.
Absolutely.
So why isn't that the proper analogy?
No, I think it is. I mean, here in the case, in our case, even if you assume that there was an improper obtainment and there was a disclosure, which obviously those issues are in dispute and weren't adjudicated by Judge Hale, there still would have to be some, I think, tangible, you know, manifestation of harm. It's not sufficient enough simply to claim a right of privacy. But again, this is a fact-specific case. It's hard to address that and not get into the tall weeds as to how the credit report was pulled, that it was, like I said, solely used in the purpose of a deposition. It's really hard to sparse out those issues without tackling the circumstances surrounding the obtainment and the disclosure.
All right, your time is up. Are there other questions? All right, Mr. Taylor, your rebuttal.
You're on mute.
Sorry about that. This is my first argument in front of this court, and it's so let me just be brief in my rebuttal. I want to draw a distinction between an injury and damages. There is a distinction in the law between an injury and damages. An injury is what the court must look at to determine whether there is standing or not. Damages are the law's approximation of the loss occasioned by an injury. The injury here was the invasion upon seclusion. That is a tort that's been recognized in the First Street Statement of Torts and has been recognized for at least 100 years in the courts. The court, I'd like to also identify additional analogs that may have existed in 1789 to the invasion of privacy tort as we know it today. There was, of course, trespass. There was breach of implied contract, slander and libel, breach of confidence, breach of trust. Those types of, those sorts of torts did not involve a tangible harm. They were all intangible harms. And yet they were available as causes of action under the common law. I'd also like to address an earlier point about whether the court should look to 1789 when locating common law analogs that Congress created with the passage of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The diversity jurisdiction issue is an interesting one. If the court was limited to looking at what existed in 1789, the court wouldn't be able to address any of the diversity cases involving torts that developed since 1789. And that would be essentially a dereliction of the court's role to hear cases in diversity as outlined in Article 3, Section 2. I also want to...
Is that necessarily true? I mean, I think the state courts don't have to follow the Article 3 standing rules that federal courts are bound to follow. So it would just be a dismissal and you just have to bring it in state court.
No, absolutely. But what I'm saying is, if the courts required in diversity cases there to be a case or controversy on a common law state court claim, then, and the courts looked to 1789 for a common law analog, the court would be limited in what it could hear in diversity. Because if the tort wasn't articulated well in 1789, then the court would, the court's jurisdiction to hear diversity cases would be severely limited. The central concern in the concurrence in Spokio was the idea that, and you know, Supreme Court precedent before that was the separation of powers doctrine. Courts have always been concerned with a plaintiff who asserts a public right, because that potentially could be seen as enlarging the jurisdiction of the courts. When a plaintiff, though, sues for an individual right, when a plaintiff sues for his own loss, there is no constitutional concern there regarding the separation of powers doctrine. For these reasons, I would like to, and one final point on the merits, I do think that the appellee relies on the merits of the case for a dismissal. And I think there will be an opportunity for those arguments at a later stage in the litigation when discovery is complete. In this case, discovery was not complete. We hadn't taken all the depositions. We were in there's a motion to compel pending. For those reasons, I would ask the court to reverse the district court and remand this case for further proceedings. Thank you, Your Honors.
We appreciate the argument you've both given and will consider the case carefully. And with that, because this is the only argued case this morning, the clerk may adjourn court.
Thank you, Your Honor. If counsel may disconnect, this honorable court is now adjourned.